Indifference is the attitude that one has in the face of nothing. One expects nothing from nothingness. I wonder if there is not, in the case of the indifferent woman, that fear of being swept up in love, a fear found in the hard-hearted and the self-sufficient. Love is a risk that she does not wish to take, for love is able to sweep you away. Gone is the comfortable quiet, and the pretty, pharisaical assurances, the day when she is burned by her own fire. And precisely, if there were an explanation, and if this explanation gave an appearance of a goodness of heart in the partner, if it proved that he was not all wrong, would she not be tempted to love him? Or at least would she not cease to have reason not to love him? For we keep these reasons, protect them, and nourish them. We do not wish to be Tom from our egoism. It is warm, like a bed at the moment of awakening. She prefers to stay there, hidden. Certain people have a secret instinct which makes them turn away from the temptation to love with the same spontaneity that others turn away from the temptation to sin. This fear of risking love is also found in the soul's relations with God. Priests know well the category of Christians who flee at tete-a-tete with God, dreading to be fascinated by the fire and preferring the semi-darkness. The refusal to explain oneself is one of the gravest sins against love, one of the most obvious signs of egoism. It is true that one finds oneself rarely confronted with extreme cases such as those which are found in Mauriac. But their merit is to make us discover in our heart the first symptoms of the evil which is killing them. In most homes there is not a wall between husband and wife, but simply a thin veneer keeping them apart. Yet how difficult it is to explain oneself, to open the door. It is true that to explain costs dearly. It necessitates raising the mask, being true, unveiling the heart. And to unveil the heart is already to give oneself to love. Often the husband does not have the desire to love, the generosity to take the first step. He does not wish to be the first to speak the words of love. Certainly this demands courage. It means leaving his armor, rendering himself vulnerable. And he is afraid of this wound, the most penetrating and consummate of all, that a refusal costs when one offers the best of oneself. He comes forward, heart bared, to begin talks of peace and love. The other takes advantage of him and aims at his heart. Woe to him who discourages love, writes Bermanos. Woe to him who does not take seriously, or suspects other interests, of this extended hand. These gestures of love are only possible. I, after a long interior debate, only after a heroic victory over egoism. To try again when he has been rebuffed demands great strength of heart. However, he must not resign himself to defeat. Later he risks being too late, hearts stiffen like knees in a cast. They must be freed so much more completely after each refusal of admittance. How difficult to pronounce anew this true word of love in the middle of this desert frosted with silence. And if again he is not listened to, and if he is scoffed at, it will be more difficult to say it again, and still more so to say it again at the opportune moment, without impatience and without caring what others think. But all is possible with much patience, and especially with faith in a God who never deserts the man who fights for the victory of love. Troubled homes. With apprehension I undertake this subject. I think of so many couples who are going to read it, hoping against help for some help. How they suffer, the beautiful dreams of youth which believed in love, in life, in happiness, have been subjected to the erosion of time. Perhaps they, too, have collapsed. However, refusing defeat, they look for someone who can help them shore up, repair, and reconstruct their sorely tried home. Will these pages, like so many words already heard before, deceive and irritate them? It is so easy to hurt those who suffer. Will they not be able to lament, one more time, "No one understands me"? What makes it still more difficult to help them is that no two cases are alike. If it is difficult to counsel this man or woman who comes to confide his distress, how much more apprehensive one is in speaking to thousands at one time. There are things which one cannot say, it seems, except in a tone of confidence. However, I cannot but address some words which I believe basic and which experience has demonstrated to be efficacious to the many broken hearts everywhere. If they do find in these lines nothing which suits them particularly, they know at least that I come to them with an infinite sympathy. To broken homes I have one thing to say above all: do not resign yourself to separation. You must not forget that to contract marriage is to take upon oneself the ceaseless wishing and pursuing of a total union. It takes two to make this commitment, but for what follows one is not freed from the union because the other neglects it or denies it. The great fault of so many married Christians is to refuse to work for union. This implies accepting the separation. Those who work at this union without believing in it, without wishing it truly, are also lacking in their obligations. I remember this passage from a letter of a man unhappy in his home: "It is necessary to give oneself, to be so stripped of self as not to be interested in the success or the failure of the union envisaged." And he added, "A soldier departs for the attack, even when he knows that it will fail. Is this not still greater and more meritorious?" I admire this man's not hesitating to leave for the attack, but in his stoicism I believe I discern a resignation to defeat. And this is not Christian. Even if conjugal harmony were simply a luxury or comfort, the partners would not have the right to renounce it. But it isn't. It is necessary both to themselves and to many others. Its failure hurts others as much as themselves. A home where discord reigns, itself becomes the seedbed of all the capital sins and often involves the moral failure of one or the other of the two spouses. We know that for the children a climate of love is a basic condition of physical and moral growth. The discord of parents tears apart their most intimate being. Society itself suffers from this failure. For it, the home is no longer a living cell, dispenser of heat and light, but a tumor which is developed at the expense of the social body. But what do we do? Each particular case demands its proper response. There are, however, remarks of a general order which can be useful to anyone who refuses defeat. An attempt at lucidity. First of all, it is necessary to make an attempt at lucidity. It is necessary to want to see, even if that involves discoveries which hurt, even if this means betraying faults and condemning oneself. How desirable it would be that this effort be made together. In fact, at the very moment couples undertake it together, they are already closer together. One must do everything so that an honest conversation will one day be possible. Do everything does not mean to take things up brusquely, it often indicates the great wisdom of knowing how to wait, to temporize. A false move risks a setback, perhaps imperiling the healing of the wound. It is not just knowing how to wait with patience and prudence, because it does not mean evading questions by cowardice. Isn't the darkness filled with menacing forms which vanish as if by magic when you strike a light? To bring to light is to look for the causes of evil. The most visible are not always the most genuine. We must not become hypnotized by them. It is important to go beyond the obvious. Without fearing to state the faults of the partner, one must not blind oneself to one's own. It is necessary to face them. I would like to believe that many situations happen because the couples recoil before an effort of searching frankness. If they would make this effort, then everything would unravel itself quickly. Truth liberates. Once the causes of evil are identified, it is necessary to preoccupy oneself with true remedies. Change of heart. The first of these remedies is often to change the heart. Ah, I well know that it is easier to wait for the partner to reform, but if both react thus, there is not much chance for progress. How many things must be corrected in the depths of the heart? And first of all, how about the ever tenacious illusion of a perfect happiness? As if this perfect happiness is able to exist on earth, as if marriage must bring happiness ready-made. How many catastrophes have their origin in this illusion of so many young couples? It is time to be rid of it, once and for all. Then one must conduct an attack on deception and its poisonous fruits, rancor, animosities take root in a heart which believes itself wronged. Look a little closer and you will discern in all this the sentiment that I have not yet named, to which few dare to give its proper name, hate. I beg of you, do not think too quickly while reading this word that this passion is a stranger to you. I well know that in our overactive lives today, nerves quickly get the upper hand although we have no bad intention. And I am careful not to confuse impatience and hate. But I know also that it is dangerous to give free rein to these irritations which, benign at the beginning, contaminate the heart and risk stirring up hatred. Let us have courage to call this snake within us by its name when it rears its head, stands erect, and hisses. Is it not hatred which betrays itself in so many reactions and reflections? This joy of surprising the other in his wrong, this bitter need to be right against him, this venomous allusion to a past sin, this brooding over griefs, as a hunter shoots arrows at a carcass, to show the poison of malice in a word or an action, is this not hate, more or less grave as the case may be, but always pernicious? For a time it can live with love, but one day, this encroaching parasite will stifle love. All of us must cultivate in ourselves the antidote of hate, a forgiving compassion. To pardon is to tear out the page on which one has written with malice or rage the debit account of the partner and to offer him instead the gift of an unreserved heart. I well know that here we are touching on one of the nerve centers of the life of the home. It is useless to search for other remedies if one has not obtained the grace of knowing how to pardon 7 times 70 if necessary. And what a relief to the pardoned heart! Gone is the destructive climate of groans and reproaches, claims and counterclaims. Doubtless the pain remains, but there is no more bitterness. And because one has taken the lead of pardon, not a haughty pardon, but the humble pardon which does not hesitate to recognize one's own faults, perhaps the partner will have a rebirth of love. A change of heart is a change in point of view. To abandon the critical view is to adopt a view of love which, along the more or less rugged bark, sees a living sap working at the inside, preparing the buds and flowers of a springtime which is often closer than one thinks. Who will say that, in this seemingly indifferent being, hard and contradictory, there is not the heart of a child who cries and calls for help? So many adults pretending to be evildoers are only poor urchins who need to be soothed. So many things and so many people have deceived them or hurt them that they no longer dare to believe in love and they dress in armor to protect themselves from blows. Your loving regard will pierce the armor. Work for the happiness of others. Having changed his heart, one must reeducate it. He has forgotten how to love, it is necessary to learn again. Recall the love of which you spoke on the day of your engagement. You promised to make him happy because you believed you could. Turn to the resolutions of those radiant hours. Understand what is wrong in your way of doing things and avoid these things scrupulously. Divine his wishes, force yourself to respond to them. Let nothing of his interior world be a stranger to you. Take interest in his thoughts, in his sentiments, in his joys, in his sufferings, in his enterprises. Discern what you like about him and what he does, what merits your admiration in these things and know how to tell him of it. Do not fail to recognize his acts of delicacy, modest or clumsy as they are, by which he tries to give you evidence of love. Thus you encourage him to love. Encourage him to give, also. He must know that you need him. Perhaps this source, which in all men is the image of the most secret impulse of the heart of God, the desire to make others happy, is not yet destroyed in him. Have you noticed that I have not spoken to you of working on the religious conversion of your partner, as much as he has need of it, but only of his happiness? I believe in fact that the best way, preferable to all sermons and all zeal, to obtain the transformation of the other is to work at bringing him joy. Is it not the thought which St.